Greetings, programs, and welcome to another episode of Quarks and Recreation. I'm your co-host, Doug.
I'm your other co-host, Brandon.
And today we're talking about the science of video games. So to help us do that, we brought in an expert. His name is Gary Butterfield, and he's the host of a number of really awesome video game-related podcasts through a network called DuckFeed.tv. Gary, you want to talk a little bit about your gaming background?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. So I have been playing games for most of my life. Started playing games when I was probably like 5 or 6 with an Atari in my family. Tiny joust tournaments as a kid. But only started kind of thinking about games. Maybe 6-7 years ago, we started Watch Out for Fireballs 5 years ago, which is a book club except for old games. And essentially, we just kind of go through the entire thing, kind of figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And that's kind of when I got into actually trying to figure out. I've always been interested. If I don't like something, I always want to know why. And if I like something, I want to know why. And this is the kind of impetus that got me to start thinking about those things. In a serious way.
Yeah, one of the reasons I thought it'd be awesome to invite you on is I listened to your specific episode on that you did a public talk with your co-host called Lessons from Lordran, which was all about the really brilliant design of a game called Dark Souls, and specifically key elements within that game that worked really, really well. And I thought that would apply to some of the science stuff we'd be talking about here.
Absolutely. Yeah, the Dark Souls is kind of the omni example for almost anything you want to illustrate about anything. You can use Dark Souls either this Dark Souls does this better, or Dark Souls does it this way, and you can talk about almost anything.
Yeah, it's a really complex game, which I think, and not just complex, but it's a complex and balanced game, which is the key. That it's not just they put all this stuff into it, but it all works in concert with each other element. So it feels like a unified whole. So where I thought we would start off talking about kind of the science of this is sort of the science of what is a game, not just a video game, but any game. And that kind of brings us back to a field of mathematics called game theory that was developed first in the 1940s by a guy named John von Neumann. And what he was trying to do was describe a very discrete type of competition or cooperation scenario, and it ended up, have you ever heard of something called the Prisoner's Dilemma, Brandon?
No.
Okay, so here's how the Prisoner's Dilemma works. Imagine you get arrested and you go to jail, and Gary also commits the crime, or may have committed the crime, and he, being a terrible person that he is, and he goes to jail with you. You are put in two separate cells, and the guards each tell you the same thing. They tell you that the other one has confessed to the crime. And you have to decide what you're going to do. And there's several different outcomes. So think about what would happen. Let's, without knowing whether or not Gary actually confessed to the crime, what would you do?
I guess I'd say I didn't do it, right?
Okay, that's one route.
But try to escape? I don't know.
Well, okay. no one built escape into this scenario, so we'll take that one off the table. But what he's looking at is the psychology, right? Because you don't know whether or not it's actually true. They could be lying to you. So the best outcome is that you and Gary both say nothing. But if you confess and he doesn't, you might get a lighter sentence. So now you have to balance, if we both confess, we end up screwing each other and we both go down. Or if we both say nothing, we may walk out of there scot-free if there's no evidence against us. So what John von Neumann was trying to do was describe the mathematics of these different possible outcomes and how you get there. And that led him to develop this branch of mathematics that can now be applied to almost any game in the world. So I kind of wanted to use that as the basis. So if you look at it, it looks at everything through this lens of four factors. The factors are, who are the players in the game? What information is available to the player? What different types of moves can the player make? And what are the relative risks and rewards for making those moves? So once you've got that, you can apply that to anything. So, what's a game that you really like? Either a video game or not?
Let's do Last of Us.
Okay, so The Last of Us is, Gary, you've played it. You want to describe a little bit about what this is?
Yeah, The Last of Us is kind of a cinematic action narrative game in which a character guides a young ward through a kind of post-apocalyptic world that has been overtaken by what are essentially zombies, and you kind of make your way from set piece to set piece, you know, advancing the story, trying to get to this kind of end goal, either engaging through kind of some like light resource management and kind of crafting systems, and then primarily stealth and shooting, kind of cover-based shooting.
Yeah, and I think the main thing that kind of separates The Last of Us from a lot of other games is that its key mechanic is actually listening in a lot of ways.
Yeah, even though they visually represent that, which is kind of a cop-out. You know, you kind of have a daredevil vision from time to time where you can do that. But you have to be very situationally aware. But to kind of use the example when you're talking about the description of a game, in that situation, you know, if you are Joel, the main character of that game, and you come across a subway full of clickers, you are the player of the game. The information you have available is some of the triangulating their location. You know their behavior a little bit because you've been through it. You know how the physics in the game work. Your actions available would be, you know, to try to sneak around them, to try to make a break for it, to run, you know, throw a distraction, or try to engage them in combat. And then the payoffs, the payoff is always going to be what you want is to actually just get through the scenario. But the risks, the negative payoff or negative outcomes for any of those could have kind of varying degrees of probability. They're tough to take in a fight. You're going to use resources to do that. And if you throw a bottle or what have you, you could attract more. So that is kind of the heavy risk element to those different kind of four choices that you have.
Right. And so the key to making any game work is making sure that in any given scenario that they are giving you enough information to make the choices based on the options you have available. So it'd be one thing if they said, okay, well, there's a room full of clickers, and you've got one bullet, and you don't know where any of them are. The game would feel really unbalanced, but the game gives you a chance to at least figure out where they are in relation to you, and then give you a path to either sneak around them, get through unnoticed, or take them on in combat, or whatever you want to do. I kind of put in here an interesting example of trying to figure out, like, how would you balance a simple game like baseball? So, Brandon, you play baseball. Mm-hmm. What would the game be like if there were, say, instead of bases 1, 2, 3 and home, if there were 4 bases? How would that affect the game?
Nobody can ever score, I guess, or I think it would be harder to score.
Well, you do a couple of things, right? You increase the chances for somebody to get out.
Yeah.
And you also have to reconfigure the geometry because you got to figure how are they going to be the same distance apart, mm-hmm. or are they going to be closer together? Because if they're too close together, then, yeah, people are going to get out to...
Because in baseball, 90 feet per base, so you'd have to figure out...
Okay, so the 90 feet is going to be based on a couple of things that the players know, which is how fast can the average person run and versus how long it takes to get a ball back to the baseman. So so there seems to be a roughly even chance that the person will either get out or be safe, mm-hmm. right? So assuming you want to add those extra bases, well, what happens to the rest of the field? Right, because
exactly.
your infield now takes up a lot more space than it used to, but the distance that a human can hit a baseball doesn't change. That's a physical limitation on the people playing the game.
I think it makes it unfair on an offensive side.
Okay,
offense being, well, I feel like first of all, it's more if it's 90 foot per base, it's more running, harder to get a score, just kind of everything you said, just.
Well, you can imagine a game that had that, but you'd have to tweak it, right? You would have to change other factors about the game to make it to balance it again. So, like
baseball guns,
baseball.
You don't have guns that shoot baseballs,
right?
The you can't throw something that fast, so you just need to get a cannon. What's interesting though, because you talk about it being unfair to the defensive side or the offensive side, is that in baseball, the teams take turns. So we would. It's kind of there's an inherent fairness in that, but there's another factor that baseball is going for, which is like they want it to not be boring, or it also kind of serves as entertainment. So like what you're going for is it. You know, the offensive side should have a reasonably good chance to score because you want to actually get points on the board and have something to compare. In the version we're describing, even if you extend it and there are 6 bases or 7 bases, it would be incredibly hard to score. It wouldn't inherently be an unfair game because both teams get a chance at that. It would just be a slower paced, more boring game, but it wouldn't inherently break the fairness of like a game.
Right, but there's a trade-off, right?
Yeah.
So you add something to one side of the equation, you have to balance it somewhere else. So sort of like we were saying with The Last of Us, the key thing is if you make a lot of noise, they come running. Well, you can dumb down the listening skills of the enemies to make it easier to sneak around, but then you would want to do something else to offset the fact that that is now easier. Well, then maybe if they do engage you, they're tougher to kill, or they move faster. Or there's some other way in which the game levels the playing field a bit. But video games are sort of also different in that you, unless you're playing a facsimile of a real game, like, you know, a digitized version of football or baseball, or a multiplayer thing like Call of Duty where you're playing against real humans, you're usually playing against a machine opponent. And so you're either playing against the intelligence of the opponents in the game, or you're playing essentially against the intelligence of the guys designing the game. So I think that's an interesting... There's plenty of games we say, like Dark Souls is another example, where not only do they have enemies that are designed, but the way they've placed them or where they are and how they react, there's almost a puzzle to figuring out how should I approach this.
Yeah. There's like a chess-like element to it. Like these things are going to move in a specific way, and as you play the game and observe the different enemies, you get to see how they're going to react to, you know, if I juke right or juke left, or if I walk in slow with my shield up, you know, or if I try to engage them from range. So when you're looking at the player and you're looking at those different kind of moves you have available to you, part of the game, part of learning the game, is figuring out how all of these individual entities will react to all of those moves. And it creates, you know, when you look at a diagram of game theory, it is like a series of webs. It's like a series of rivers with tributaries that go out. And that's what that is.
Right. If I do this, then this happens.
Yes.
And just sort of like any non-video game, that there is usually certain strategies have better advantages than others. And in fact, in games, more so in video games, there's even ways to sometimes do what's called sequence breaking or break the game, where you can come up with some strategy that the programmers themselves had never even thought of. And there's even versions that, like the one I thought of in baseball would be a sacrifice fly, right? Like there's like Brandon, why would you use a sacrifice fly in baseball? The advantage of doing that?
Like as a hitter?
Yeah, if you're the person hitting, what makes you decide I should make this a sacrifice fly?
Well, I guess because not to get into a double play, just to say like he's out because that ball is, instead of, it's an advantage. I mean, obviously it's not as much as advantage as just not getting as many people out.
Well, you're basically deciding I'm going to get out for the good of the...
Yeah, like a sacrifice.
Right. And to me, that's a way of sort of breaking that game, because in theory, the rules are encouraging you just hit this thing as hard and as far as you possibly can. Mm-hmm. But eventually someone figured out, ooh, if I do this move, yes, in the short term, I get out, but I set up something else for later on.
It reminds me of, I don't know if you have heard about this, but when I think it is Arthur Chu, when he was on Jeopardy, do you know the story I'm talking about?
I do know that guy, yeah.
Yeah, he the way that he did so well on Jeopardy was not following the traditions or the ways the game expects you to play. So he would choose clues in kind of random spots. He would go for the high value ones first rather than working your way up the ladder. And just kind of, he drove people crazy not playing the game the way that it's expected to be played.
Except
and
he wasn't actually breaking any of the rules.
No, there's rules, but then there's also kind of the way the game is encouraging you to play. So like a sacrifice fly isn't breaking a rule; it's just going against the assumptions that the game makes.
Right.
You know,
it's counterintuitive to the way. Yeah, and exactly. I think Arthur Chu is a good example, because what he was doing, instead of doing the normal Jeopardy thing, which is I pick a category and I just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down the line, he would pick all these random spots and. He realized, what he was doing was trying to confuse the other players. That you, if you answer three questions in a row that are kind of on the same topic, your brain is in a certain mindset to answer them. But by jumping around, it's like, oh, I got to go from history to sports to science to you know, language or something else. And again, not breaking any of the rules of the game, but employing an unforeseen strategy. Kind of looking at the way games do this, video games do it, there's in addition to sort of the way they spool out information to you, well, maybe we can stop there for a little bit. I think that's a really interesting one in terms of the way games signpost what you are supposed to do, because they give you a manual that tells you kind of what you can do. But then as you progress through a game, there's a lot of figuring out, you know, how are they signaling to me what I should do? How, you know, because sometimes they'll say there's a hidden path over here, but they can't make it too hidden so you don't find it. But if they put it out in the open, it's no fun. So, I mean, Gary, you can probably think of some good examples of not just Dark Souls, but other games that do this as well, in the way they sort of play off of your senses to get you where they want you to go.
Yeah, kind of a master class in this, if you're at all interested, and even if you are not a video game person, are the commentary tracks on Valve games. Valve is the company that did Portal 1 and 2, Left 4 Dead, Half-Life, Team Fortress.
And someday Half-Life 3.
Yeah, perhaps. Like, there's just so little money in like a single player game. It bums me out because I would like to see how that story ends. Mm-hmm. But they do these commentary tracks and they're incredible. It is the developer saying like, "Hey, we wanted the players to go down this alley. Here's how we do that." And they, you know, they park a car across the alley that has its headlights shining in there, or they have a flickering lamppost at the top of that alley. There's just things that draw the eye. That kind of come down to these visual composition clues, but you don't notice any of it. It is, you know, 100%, it is 99% invisible, to quote the podcast that talks about this very thing a lot of the time. You just don't notice it, but once you see the strings, it's really kind of incredible to see the artistry of it. And even, like I said, even people who don't like their games or don't like video games at all, I think could benefit from watching those commentaries, because it is really interesting the amount of thought that goes into things you take for granted.
Yeah, well, I think what's different about the medium is when it's a movie, they can point the camera at something specifically. Yeah. A game, they're relying on you to be sort of the archaeologist of this world and find your way to it.
They have to coax you.
Right.
They can't force you.
So
I mean, they can. So an inelegant example of that happens a lot in modern Zelda games, where in a modern Zelda game, which are these kind of, you know, for people who are listening, they are these kind of action-adventure, you go into dungeons to get treasure a lot of the time. And when you go into a room and the game wants you to look at something, the camera will actually take control away from you and point you at the goal. That, you know, point at the goal you have in the room and then let you have control again. So you know exactly, I need to go press that switch. And that's an inelegant way to do it, I would say. As opposed to just drawing the eye or having the switch show up in the background or seeing an enemy use the switch earlier, just something you're going to notice without really having it in your conscious brain. There's a way to kind of do that in a ham-fisted manner. As well.
And your eyes can be very, very manipulated in a lot of different ways. I mean, your human eye can discern 10 million colors, and that's great, but that's not the same thing as being able to pick out every single thing on the screen and figure out where you want to go. In fact, there's a whole branch of science related to this called human factors, which deals with, you know, what are the capabilities of your senses and how do they get fooled all the time, or how quickly can you react to a certain thing. So if they put a bunch of sparkly stuff all over the switch in the distance, that's one step removed from what you were talking about, where they swivel the camera and say, look at this thing. They'll just try and put a few little cues like that to draw your eye there. And the degree to which they want to do that kind of varies on what, you know, how much do they want to make this obvious versus how much is it going to be the thing that people on the internet are talking about. Oh man, did you go buy that other thing? You know, like one random person found it.
What you want is the game to do a portion of the work to where the player still feels responsible for the epiphany. Mm-hmm. Moment. You need to, you know, like a good, if you think of all these things as puzzles, like a good puzzle gives you the information you need to solve it. It needs to give you the information, but you need to make that final step so you feel good about yourself when you do it. So like when you come to like a, you know, when you find that secret wall or what have you, it's not because the game pointed at you or it just there's a glowing arrow on the ground. It's because you deduce the clues. Even if the puzzle is very simple, you have that little dopamine feeling of I've done something, I'm smart,
right?
You know, and that's what you're trying to coax out of the player with good level design.
Yeah, and by the same token, it can't be so hidden that you're like, oh, that hidden wall, the only way you would find it is by randomly trying every single point in the game. That's not a puzzle either. That's
right.
You know,
which is really fascinating to look at, again, like Zelda as an example, because that happens all the time. And the first Nintendo Zelda is just their original random bushes that need to be burned. And there's nothing to indicate that. And then they, you know, had kind of a sweet spot, and then they moved very far in the other direction where they reacted like a 180 against that. Like, we're not going to make you search for anything. So that series kind of serves as a spectrum.
Yeah, and that may be a function of their worlds getting so large that they figure, well, if the world, you know, the original Nintendo Zelda is a much smaller space to search. If they're telling you, go find a needle in a haystack, that's not really fun anymore. It's now an arduous task.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, to me, when a game is fun is when it's it's kind of pulling you along just enough without making you it feel like a chore or work. And that's a difficult balance to strike.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There's a formula out there, and I was gonna look it up for this, and I apologize, it slipped my mind, but there's an equation for fun that has to do with the amount of meaningful decisions you're making over time. So getting that pace, like I'm making a meaningful decision at a certain interval, and that is what's going to keep me engaged, and that is one definition of fun. And this is what that does. You can search everywhere for a thing, you are making too many decisions over too short amount of time, because you can literally put that fire or check every single wall, every space on that wall. And if you are making one decision over a long period of time, because all you're deciding to do is just walk over to the place the camera showed you, that's not enough. So it's finding that number of meaningful decisions over the correct amount of time and getting that ratio solid.
I think that's exactly right. Kind of going back to the human factor stuff, one of the other things I had on my notes here is ergonomics, which is sort of how you then exert your will over this virtual avatar of yours in the game that, you know, I want my character to perform a certain action. How do I get it to do that? And there's a lot of, if you go over the kind of the history of games, especially since you and I are both started as Atari kids, there you can watch as you go through the progression of games, like games that sort of made the right evolutionary step and ones that didn't. And they sort of will... once one kind of developer stumbles on a solution to a problem, say how to make this game work in 3D space or things like that, then all of a sudden they'll glom onto it and they'll all kind of be the same. So like, Brandon, you talked about The Last of Us. What's another game that you really like?
Well, I like Call of Duty Black Ops, but I like their multiplayer and zombies, but I hate the campaign.
Okay.
But
that's just based on the story being boring?
Yeah,
or?
I didn't even get very far. I just thought it was very... boring.
Okay, what the story or the gameplay?
The story.
Okay, so let's take the story out of the equation and just look at the gameplay. So that is a first-person shooter game for the audience. That you are not seeing your character move around. You're looking out of your character's eyes and you're firing weapons towards whatever is down the screen from you. The first versions of that I can think of. I mean, Wolfenstein is kind of the big one as the progenitor of that series. But I think there were a few first-person shooters before that.
I can never remember the name of it, but there's the one that came before Wolfenstein that is like a sorcery based maze thing. As the same people, but it's pretty much Wolfenstein is good for most intents and purposes as the first one.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example of, you know, how do you, again, one, it takes place in 3D space. Mm-hmm. So besides the programming challenge of how do we program a 3D environment, you have the sense of like, well, how do we make this interesting? How do we get a person to go through this, what is essentially a series of hallways or mazes from one end to the other, encounter these enemies and deal with them in a way that's fair and balanced? So, you know, you have to kind of power down the enemies because in real life, if you took one bullet, you'd probably be done. You have to find a way to make these mazes signposted so that you can find your way through them. Especially that was a problem in like old, like Wolfenstein games or Doom games that, they were very, very homogenous in the way they looked. It was like, all right, I have no idea where in this labyrinth I am anymore.
They just didn't, in those early games, they didn't solve the problem. They were just mazes like you would find on the back of the, like a Denny's menu, essentially, except you move through them in first person, which like, you know, there are heads mazes, there is some fun to be had in that, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as fun as it could be, and it quickly kind of became, you know, there are other factors that interfere with that, where like part of it is like a sense of place that you can have. You know, if you're going to have any kind of sense of immersion, and you're going to feel like I am actually BJ Blazkowicz, like fighting Nazis in this prison, the prison should feel a little bit like a prison. You know, real buildings are not laid out like mazes.
Because they're designed for people to actually get where they're trying to go.
And that's been, you know, a more modern take on that, you know, on games, is to have that, like, a sense of, this is actually a space that people use. So when you play, like, a modern Call of Duty game or a modern shooter, a lot of time you will be in city streets, or you will go into an office building for a period. Like, this is and it's very clearly, like, this is a place where people live, this is a place where people work, this space makes sense, and you have less of that dissonance of feeling like you're in a video game level.
And it gives you a chance to do environmental storytelling too, which is more modern now that they have the processing power to do it. So like Last of Us is a great example of that. When you're going through it, you can find, you know, where two dead bodies are laid out, mm-hmm. might tell you a story about, just by looking at it, who those people were and what happened to them.
You could find the notes too.
Sure, there's notes, but I'm just talking about just looking around, seeing, you know, the knickknacks left on people's desks and stuff as you go through there. And at the same time, they can still make it a labyrinth by blocking off certain doors with, you know, garbage or, you know, detritus or whatever. So you are forced down these labyrinthine paths without it just looking literally like a digital hedge maze.
Yeah,
you get fooled. And again, like, you know, you want to be fooled. That's the idea. And you're spending less time thinking about the level and more time thinking about what the developers want you to think, which is, you know, your actual goal, like getting forward, moving the story forward, getting the points or whatever the various things that you need to do. You're spending less time just thinking about how ridiculous the space is.
And then sort of going back to the ergonomics thing, like, how do you make your character do this? In the first-person shooter space, it took them a while to figure out even how to get you to, like, kind of aim correctly. Like, I remember those first games, those Wolfenstein games, you couldn't aim up or down. You couldn't use your mouse to look around, which is hard when you're trying to point a gun at something. It took them a while to even learn how to do that. In, like, a platforming genre, like, Gary also hosts a podcast called Abject Suffering, which is the opposite of Watch Out for Fireballs, where they talk about terrible games. It's a terrible game book club. And one of the things that I remember you mentioning, which was a bane I remember for some of these games when I was growing up, was pressing up to jump.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Which just doesn't feel good. Like, you're already doing things with that button. And that kind of comes down to sometimes games would do that for no reason at all, which is when they're the most frustrating. Sometimes they would do it because there aren't enough buttons on the controller at the time. You know, they were still trying to figure that out. The A and B button, which are standard, that's mapped real estate. You know, so as games kind of developed, they figured out more how to get around that problem. Like, oh, like, we now have like 6 buttons or 8 buttons on a controller standard, or 10, and now we have enough room to where we can make this a dedicated button. You can do this, you know, not while you're navigating. And the reason why up to jump feels so bad is because you're already controlling your x-axis with your left hand. You don't want to control your, because you want those things to work in concert. You want to be able to jump forward. You want to be able to jump backwards. It's not just jumping straight up.
Yeah, and that's just there's sort of a clear human limitation that you've only got 10 fingers to work with, and they're assembled a certain way. So, like, if you look at say a more modern game controller, starting with the Super Nintendo forwards. So the original Nintendo, have you ever probably ever seen an original Nintendo controller, Brandon? Are you that young? He's born in 2001. But you played Wii, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you take a Wii controller and turn it on its side, where you've got the directional pad on your left and then the 2 buttons on the right, that's basically the way the original
NES... Oh, it was like circular, kind of. Or like a jelly bean?
No, that's the GameCube, maybe.
Okay.
Or the SNES.
Super Nintendo, yeah.
Yeah, but the original Nintendo Entertainment System controller, which was the first kind of controller that wasn't a joystick. This is their first attempt at making something that was like a paddle that you could hold in your hand. Was a rectangle, and it had the A B button horizontally and the directional pad for up, down, left, right on the side, on the other side. When they went to the Super Nintendo, they added 4 buttons on the left. So they, instead of just A and B, it was A, B, X, and Y. But what they did was they rotated it 90 degrees. So instead of them being 45 degrees, so instead of it being a horizontal, they're all in a diagonal diamond formation. And you see that now, like your PlayStation controller. It's that they all do that. And there's a very simple reason for that, which is your thumbs go this way.
So far.
Yeah. Otherwise, you have to hold it up like this, and it's uncomfortable. That's ergonomics. That's the science of, like, how should I actually make this thing work with my meat hands that have just these limitations I can't get around. Can you think of any other games, Gary? I'm sure that you've had plenty in the Abject Suffering catalog of, like, things where it just felt wrong in your hands, like the way it played. Not just the controller, but say the way the controller and the game interacted.
This isn't an Abject Suffering thing, but something that I think is always really interesting when the subject comes up is to talk about the old Resident Evil games.
Oh, yeah, the tank controls.
Yeah, tank controls. But the interesting thing about Resident Evil, and something that is true of all of the... So for people who don't know, who are listening, Resident Evil is a horror game where you explore an area that is full of zombies, generally. And one of the hooks of it, it has a lot of DNA with old adventure games. So you're finding items and combining them to solve puzzles in addition to fighting. It's much slower paced than Wolfenstein, or even slower paced than The Last of Us, really. And... the way that it controls is that your character, when you press up, your character moves forward relative to your character, not relative to the player.
Or the screen.
Yes, or to the screen, or it's just whatever way your character happens to be facing up will move them forward, like they're controlling a tank.
Right, it's like you're driving a person like a car. You have to, like, accelerate the person or brake the person. If you can kind of think of them as a car, it's easier to wrap your brain around it, but it's really, like, unintuitive.
It's very unintuitive, but one of the things that's really cool about it, and this goes for most of the kind of general principles we've talked about, is that these have become such a rote part of the vocabulary of games that you can subvert them to kind of great effect. So Resident Evil doesn't control bad. It does this because it wants to add an extra barrier between, like, it's disempowering you. Like, it's making you feel more helpless against these zombies. You are not, like, a super well-equipped action person. You are just a regular person. The way they use kind of gameplay to illustrate that is to make it hard for you to move around. You know, maybe even harder than you would, it would really be to move around, but they need to disempower the player. It's to a purpose.
Right. It's for an emotional effect. It's now you feel more scared because you have less, a feeling of less control over your avatar.
Mm-hmm. It's really cool the way that these rules have been kind of set up through this really young medium, and then get broken or get played with. And that the game's a really good example of that.
Yeah, I was going to talk about another thing that is interesting in terms of that, which is choice. That this is a new, or moral choice. That this is kind of a new thing to games, relatively speaking. That it used to be that, you know, you would sort of go through the game and it was fairly scripted in terms of what you did. And developers started going, well, what if we gave you a choice to do this instead of that?
Like the Walking Dead games?
The Walking Dead game is a great example of that, where you make very clear moral choices. This person lives, this person dies. Sometimes it's expressed in more of an absolute good or evil. Mass Effect games do this, where you have a series of dialogue options, and some of them are actually green or red, like really good choice or really, you know, evil choice. And what you do affects the downstream plot of the game to some degree. That, you know, oh, because I was mean to this person, they won't help me on later, and therefore this segment of the game is going to be more challenging without their help. Or it manifests in other ways. But it's an interesting way in which games can kind of now start playing on your emotions in the way they couldn't before.
It plays on your emotions, and it plays on some of that kind of game theory thing about the agents having complete information. You know, because when you make a choice, the game is saying, like, hey, this is a good choice, this is a bad choice. But The Walking Dead does a lot of things where you don't know if it is a good choice or bad choice long term. And they ramp up that pressure. They don't want you to be able to think about it for very long. They're trying to engage you emotionally and not let you kind of game the system. Like, you can't choose the optimal thing. There's nothing that's saying a character A or character B, I don't know whether one of them is going to be more useful than the other one later. It's just, which one do I like more?
Right. And I think there's games that do this well and games that don't do it. Walking Dead does it well because they're deliberately trying to not make it clear to you which choice is necessarily better off all the time. But I can think of a game that, a much earlier game that tried this. Did you ever play Under a Killing Moon, Gary?
I have not. I'm familiar with it, but I haven't played it. The Tex Murphy game, right?
Yeah. So this is a point-and-click adventure game where you are a private eye in a kind of a Blade Runner-esque future. And they will give you dialogue options when you talk to the player, but it won't be very clear. It's sort of like The Walking Dead. It gives you kind of a blurb that gives you some idea of what you're about to say, but it's not a script. It doesn't say, I'm going to say this sentence. It gives it almost like a comical description of how you're going to respond, and it doesn't always correspond to what you actually do. So whereas it's part of The Walking Dead in that you don't know what your choices are going to be, in Under a Killing Moon, it's frustrating because you there's what you intend to say, and then what actually comes out of your mouth is kind of something different, and then that has an effect that you don't want. And so that there again is sort of another way of, like, the game has to sort of give you enough information to make the kind of choice that the game wants you to make. Otherwise, you're sort of shooting in the dark, just like hitting against a wall or burning a random bush. You don't know where this choice actually leads, and therefore it's not really a choice.
And it's not really a choice because then it's random. The other way to kind of patch over that is no better but is also kind of equally poorly designed is kind of how the newest Fallout game did that, which was a game I actually liked, but the way they handled that was you would have your four choices that kind of suggested something, but it turned out there wasn't really much choice at all. It was just, you know, yes, no, a different kind of yes, and I will do it for money, which is a third kind of yes.
Right.
You know, so it wasn't really, they took away the choice part of it. So not only did you have complete information. But even if you had complete information, it wouldn't matter. Did you ever play something I always like to think about when thinking about morality in games? Are you familiar with Ultima 4?
I've heard of it, but I never played it.
It does a really interesting take on that, where the game kind of has these virtues, and they're traditional human real-world virtues like honesty and charity and the like, courage. And the game, you can't win the game if you don't do these things, but the game never gives you a menu that says, will you be charitable? Will you be honest? It's just up to you to give to charity and not steal from blind shopkeepers and not kill enemies that are weaker than you. Hmm. And you can't win the game unless you do that. The game says, hey, be good. And then it gives you just, if you want to be rewarded, you have to be good. But the game never signposts when you're actually making decisions, which I think is really great, because that's how real life works a lot of the time. Like, you don't really always know when you're making a choice that's going to have a huge impact.
Right. You don't, write a check to a charity and it says achievement unlocked.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, press A to be a good person. Like, that doesn't end up happening.
But then on the flip side, there's games that actually take away choice. And Brandon hasn't finished The Last of Us, but there's a scene towards the end that I'm not going to talk about. But I'll give you another example that's not nearly as emotionally impactful. But God of War 3 did this in certain ways, which is where the game could just turn into a movie where it takes over and it shows you what happens. But now they've started to do this interesting thing where you only have one choice. It's basically press X to do something, and the only other choice you have is turn off the game and not do it. But it makes you the person who's actually doing it. So in that game, you actually like rip a guy's head off, but you have to keep pressing X to do it. Like, it makes you the bad guy actually carrying out this action, as opposed to the camera or the thing turning into a movie and telling you, oh, look, you just did a bad thing. No. It makes you, the player, do that thing. And that's an interesting way to kind of psychologically flip that on its head.
My favorite example of that, and I won't spoil it if anybody doesn't know, but the game Spec Ops: The Line does like amazing things with that.
I've heard that. Yeah, that's a particularly amazing in terms of plot game as well, or emotion.
It is the most antagonistic game I've ever played. Like, it does not. The way to win that game is to turn it off and stop playing. If you go down with the ship, it condemns you for doing so. And in a way that plays with all of this stuff in a really cool way. Like, it sets up, you know, choices where it is that, you know, you just have to be complicit, and then has choices where you don't, and doesn't necessarily signal where they are. It's really testing you the entire time. And it just does that to engage. Again, like, sometimes you have incomplete information. In a classic game sense, it's not perfect, but what it's doing is engaging you kind of emotionally and questioning, like, where your feelings are going to run into those, making those choices, how those are going to factor in.
Yeah, and that feeds sort of back into that fourth element of game theory, which is, what is the reward or risk for doing a particular thing? Here, I mean, in an old-school game, it would be more points, or, mm-hmm. you know, you go up a level. And here it's like, oh, I feel like a good person because I did something nice in this virtual space. I helped out the shopkeeper. I didn't, you know, rob the blind beggar. I didn't, you know, do any of these actions. That, you know, yes, in the real world they have no consequence, but emotionally they actually still resonate. Like, Brandon, have you ever played a game that kind of did something emotionally, as opposed to just like, hey, I'm shooting stuff?
I haven't been playing games all that long.
Okay, so
I haven't been exposed to like those really great games. I mean, obviously, Last of Us is a really good game.
That's why I kind of wanted you to play that one, because I think that one is a game that focuses a lot on that emotional aspect, because they've now gotten to the point where they can tell more sophisticated types of stories, as opposed to, you are the guy in the dungeon killing the monsters. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, when you set up The Last of Us and explained what it was, you talked about, well, you're a guy in a post-apocalyptic wasteland killing zombies, which sounds like the setup for half of the games on the shelf, but in fact it's not. It's something much more subtle and interesting.
There's a point to it, and there's little plot lines within the plot.
Yeah, I mean, it plays out, it's now doing the kinds of things that, say, a movie would do, or a book, or literature in some other way. They've gotten past that.
Right, because that reminds me, because that's another kind of motivating factor, is just kind of see more of what's going on. Brandon, if not The Last of Us, can you think of a game that you played in spite of the mechanics? So maybe you did not have fun playing it, but you wanted to see the story, so you kind of went with it.
You pushed all the way through the end.
Call of Duty Ghost.
Okay.
That one. I was really bored, but I just want to see how it ended.
Right. So that's, again, the risk-reward, is that the maybe the moment-to-moment gameplay isn't as rewarding, but there's something about the story that says, I want to push forward and see this. Because I saw an interesting quote about games, which they said, you know, you can't be bad at reading a book or watching a movie, but you can be bad at a game. Like, it's the only artistic medium that fights back against you to get to the end. And that all goes back to, even, I would think, I was trying to think of, like, where did this kind of start? Even something as dumb as Ms. Pac-Man. Like, you would do a couple of levels of that, and then they'd have Ms. Pac-Man and Pac-Man come out, and they'd, like, kiss and a heart. Like, that's a pretty meager story reward, but there's something that works. Like, you're like, ooh, I got to see a little, like, something that was more than just the players moving around and dodging each other.
The context. Right. So it's contextualizing what you're doing. Like, you're not doing things because you are an avatar. You're doing it because you're Ms. Pac-Man. And your wants, even if it's just to a minor degree, are getting conflated with Ms. Pac-Man's wants. You know, she wants to, you know, at that point, like, she's going to see Mr. Pac-Man and, I don't know, hang out and have a ghost party. I don't actually know the story of that game. I'm not familiar with the lore.
The deep thematic narratives of Pac-Man.
Pac-Man side chat has not happened yet. But, like, the idea being that, you know, Donkey Kong's a better example of it, where, like, I'm not just moving an avatar. Like, I want to see Donkey Kong get to Daisy because they're buddies and it's cute together and I hate monkeys. So the, you know, it contextualizes what you're doing as opposed to something where it's Pong, you know, and you're literally just moving a shape and that shape has nothing to it.
Yeah, you know? Although to be fair, like, to be the great thing about games is sort of they can take so many different forms. Like, Tetris is a perfectly balanced game, but Tetris needs no story. Like, as a game, if you're balancing these four factors, like, who, you know, who are you playing against? You're playing against the machine and time and randomness. You've got your simple move is that I know what's coming up and I can rotate this thing, and the reward is I get to keep playing for longer if I manage to do this.
Play Tetris all day.
Right, because it's
perfect.
Yeah, it achieves that balance.
Yeah, it is like everything, it's a spectrum. So, like, the degree to which, you know, games that have that kind of, you can make up for it. So a game like The Last of Us, which I really liked, I don't think is mechanically perfect. If I was just moving around wireframes in that game, I wouldn't enjoy it. Without the story, without the context giving it. So you can use kind of one to shore up the other to make a complete package. And when those things work together, that's elegant and that's, you know, a kind of a complete whole experience. You know, Tetris doesn't need that and would suffer from it because Tetris is perfect as just a mechanical engagement. Like, you can't take away anything from Tetris or add anything to Tetris without ruining it. It is literally a perfect object.
Right.
Internet is dumb.
I did want to kind of get in here. We usually do a segment, Gary, called "The Internet is Dumb,"
because the internet,
it's just an echo chamber for a lot of bad ideas. And this one's been around forever. So this one is that violent video games cause violence in real life, and this has been like a whipping boy politically for years and years and years. But what's interesting is people were saying that for a long time before anybody actually bothered to study it and see if it's true. And to me, this is like the most important part about science, which is even people who aren't scientifically minded, if you go to them and say, hey, how do you feel about just testing stuff to see how it works? They'll usually say yes. Mm-hmm. And that's all science really is, hey, let's just test it out and see if it's true. And all the studies kind of showed kind of the opposite, that like, no matter how violent the games were, that in fact, it didn't, one, cause them to be more maladjusted people in real life. And if anything, it caused people to have more, to make better moral decisions, that the people who were playing these games were able to distance themselves from it, recognize that the violent things going on aren't good things to emulate. And in fact, that, you know, usually your object in the game is to rescue people from these horrible acts. I don't know if this ever come up in any of your shows where people have written in, or you've just seen it in the industry, or...
Not specifically. It forms an interesting kind of... So, like, I've read studies that debunk that, and I don't think that playing violent video games causes people to be violent. I'm also kind of skeptical of the idea that, like, the media we take in has no effect on us. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's necessarily true. I don't think it's an A-B kind of thing, where, like, yes, I saw something violent, I'm going to do violence. But one of the things I think about with that, and I think that where there's kind of confusion with gaming, the kind of culture recently, is that, you know, maybe it doesn't cause someone to do violence, but maybe, you know, the context around that violence is, you know, is making people feel bad, you know, like representation issues and stuff that get wrapped up in that, you know. So like, it hasn't come up the actual violence thing, because I don't, you know, it has been proven it does not actually cause violence, but it's still kind of worth talking about what, you know, if you're playing a game where it is about, you know, U.S. adventurism and they are going to other countries, you know, to kind of impose their will and you know, doing violence against a lot of people of a particular race or something like that, that says something to people who are playing those games who are maybe of that race, you know. That is still important and worth talking about. It's one of those things where that issue has a kind of comorbidity with a lot of other issues.
Or you talk about, say, feminism in games where, you know, almost every protagonist tends to be overwhelmingly male, and they're usually rescuing a damsel in distress. There's ways, yes, in which that kind of Bechdel test kind of gets funneled in there.
Yeah, so people will say, you know, just because in this game I, you know, beat up a woman, that doesn't mean I'm going to beat up a woman. Therefore, stop talking about the fact that this game makes, you know, and that's true. Like, there is, the science is true that you are not more likely to beat up a woman because you play a game where you do that. However, it's still worth examining culture, and it's still worth right. looking at the art and saying, should we be doing this? Like,
the bigger question is, why am I finding that interesting in the first place, or why exactly. are we putting it in the game?
And what does that say to, you know, young women who want to play a game, and like every game they play, they are disempowered or beat up or any number of, you know, these kind of negative things. And that goes for, you know, people of different minorities or races. So it's interesting, like the actual violence thing, it's kind of come around full circle where I don't think anybody, or I don't find a lot of the discussion to be where they actually believe that it causes violence. But the fact that it doesn't has been used as kind of a cudgel to say that we don't need to talk about anything with it, you know?
Yeah, I guess you're right. There's kind of a bad outcome on both sides to say we don't talk about it at all, because why bother? That doesn't do any good either. It doesn't affect any real world change for people that need it. Let's see, I'm looking here. Before we move on to our mailbag, is there, Brandon, any other like games you really like? Or just, we can just talk about games now. We got plenty of time.
Well, like I said earlier, I haven't really been exposed to a lot of...
What was your first console? Was it
probably...
Just
well, I mean, I had a DS, but that is
okay.
not... But
sure,
I think PlayStation 2. I think there's been a PlayStation 2 in our house longer than I've been alive.
Well, that's one of the most popular consoles of all time, so that's a good place to start.
I have a question, if it's okay.
Sure.
So Brandon, the last game, you know, you'd mentioned that you didn't like the single-player Call of Duty thing. Like, maybe other than that, because you like the multiplayer, so there's something there you like.
Yeah.
What was the last game that you played and you didn't like, and do you know why? Like, did you think about, what is this game doing that is not working for me?
Well, back to Call of Duty again. Actually, not Call of Duty. There was a... I think it was for Xbox 360. There was a tricky... some sort of tricky. And my favorite game on PlayStation 2 was Tricky, so this tricky...
Are you talking about SSX?
Yeah.
Like the snowboarding? Yeah. Yep.
And so maybe it was a different one, but I feel like for a newer system, I feel like the controls were just not good. I mean, all in all, it's a fun game, but it was just not good like the original.
What was it about the controls that were different and that made it feel like you couldn't, you know, make it do what you wanted,
I think,
or it wasn't fun?
Maybe the fact that it was more realistic, that wasn't as good. The fact that maybe the older version was better because it
broke the laws of physics more.
Yeah.
Basically, you could do weirder things.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounds like it dovetails into kind of like kinesthetics, where the older SSX games, which I really love myself, like when you hit the ground, it makes a huge noise and there's a huge kind of flash of light, and then that Run DMC song starts blasting when you're doing really well,
mm-hmm.
And it just, everything feels really big, so it feels good when you're doing it. And when I have played like a realistic sports game or a realistic racing game, when something happens, it doesn't always feel good. Like, I know that it's technically right, but the game, there's not a kind of that bombast that makes it, you know, feel kind of awesome.
You know, it's interesting that we're sort of talking about games that you rage quit. And sometimes it's the games aren't well designed, and sometimes it's what you bring to the table. Like, I told you, Gary, I think a while back that I had rage quit Dark Souls, and then have now recently come back to it, and I figured out why I like it so much now and why I couldn't handle it then, was that I was playing Bloodborne at the time, which is another game that's made by the same company, and a lot of it shares a lot of DNA, And the problem was all of the instincts I had learned playing the one game, I tried to apply to the other game, and I kept beating my head against the wall, and I finally had to figure out, this game doesn't want me to play it the same way
as Bloodborne.
The other one does. Yeah, they're very similar in the way you interact with the environment, but the combat in Bloodborne is a lot quicker. It's more about dodging and rolling, and Dark Souls is a little more about approaching things cautiously and slowly. So I kept trying to apply all this stuff that I knew from the one game to the other, and I couldn't make this thing do what I wanted it to do. And now that I've had some distance, and I said, I just have to not play them both at the same time. It's the only way I'm going to be able to make this thing on screen behave the way I want it to and the way the game really wants me to do it.
So, the way the game wants you to do it is really important, because we have kind of a responsibility to engage art the way that on its own terms. And that doesn't mean you have to like it. You just need to make a concentrated effort to play something the way that try to figure out what the piece of art is trying to do, and respect that and engage with it.
I was thinking about this with we just had the Academy Awards, and Mad Max was up for Best Picture.
Every little thing.
Yeah, but that movie is bonkers. That movie is. Yeah. I mean, that movie has nothing in common with anything else that was up for Best Picture that year or any year. Like, it's none of the Oscar bait trappings of people being sad or disabled or living in war-torn Eastern Europe during the 40s. It doesn't have any of those things that it normally has. But you look at it as, what is this movie trying to do? Like, what kind of movie is it? What does it want to be? And is it good at doing that thing? Yeah. Not, you can't look at it and go it's not a very good period piece, so
And is the thing it's trying to do worth doing?
Right.
And in the case of Mad Max, totally. I love that movie. That was 100%. That's the most excited I've been in a movie theater since I was a kid. Since I saw Jurassic Park.
Right. I mean, that movie is like just chugging caffeine, all day.
I haven't seen it.
It's good. It's super kinetic. Like, the movie, in terms of its pacing, doesn't let up for a second. And the things that are happening on screen are totally unrealistic and just beyond the pale of human imagination.
But they happened. But it's all practical and stuff. It's amazing. All the things on the screen actually happened.
With stunt doubles and stuff. Yeah. They actually did it. But again, that's the kind of the point. That's what they're actually going for. So you have to judge them on, what is this thing going for? Not what do I want it to be? Because if you're trying to judge it against other films on that basis, you're going to go, this acting is totally over the top, and it never slows down to have a character moment. But it doesn't need any. That's not what it wants. She wrote upon it. Return to sender. Address unknown. No such number.
No such song. I don't want to read all this mail.
Before we go, I do want to get to our mailbag here. We do have a couple of viewer or listener questions, so let's do that. The first one is from Joshua M., and he wants to know, do you think that virtual reality or some future technology will change the way we experience gaming? You say no?
I don't think so. Because they have one now. It's called, the Oculus.
Oculus.
Oculus. And I was watching, a react to it, and then I was reading about it, and, it's bad for the eyes and blah, blah, blah. Not, going on your computer, going on TV, is it? But I just feel like the way it looked, I don't think it's going to ever compete to, the PlayStation, or it's not going to compete with that type of stuff.
I'm skeptical, too. I don't know if you are. The reason I'm skeptical is because of things like the Wii. That, the Wii said, okay, we're going to change up how you interact with this game. Instead of just pushing buttons, you're going to swing your arms and move things, and you're going to implement all these motion controls. And sometimes, to the Wii's credit, it worked really well. And other times it just felt like a gimmick that wasn't working. So when it comes to VR, yes, obviously if this thing isn't comfortable to wear and it hurts your eyes after playing it, then it won't work. But assuming that they get that right, that at least it's not physically uncomfortable to do, I don't know if it will change the way, at least not permanently. It could just end up being a gimmick. Gary, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's going to take a long time before people start developing to its strengths. I think that we're going to have a long period of people kind of trying to shove square pegs into round holes with it. Because, you know, obviously, you look at, the advantage of the VR or the Oculus is that you can see in first person. And you look at the majority of first person games, and they involve really fast, twitchy movements that the human neck cannot do. You know, think about how fast you, like, Brandon, when you're playing Call of Duty, think about how often you have to turn around really quick. And that's just a flick of your thumb. You know, that's a, you know, and you can't do that with your head. You would die.
And even if you even tried to do it close enough, you'd get make yourself sick pretty quickly.
Yeah, it just wouldn't work. Or if they're making ones where they have these kind of co-products where you run in place, they're kind of on a treadmill as well, trying to make it so you're actually doing the things. But I don't know about you, but I will get way tired and exhausted trying to run at the speed that, like, you know, the Doom guy runs at for any amount of time. So there are certain games that would work really well for. But then it becomes too niche of a product. Like, I think that, like, horror games, it would be really good for that. Like, slow horror games or, like, walking simulator games like your Gone Homes. It might be good for that, but those are such small parts of the market. I can't see it supporting this $600
device. I would spend $600 on it. I mean, let alone I see...
Well, that's an economic question. I mean, yeah, I was just thinking from, like, the perspective of trying to play the game. Like, I was trying to think of, like a VR Assassin's Creed would be a nightmare. Like, you would be... I mean, who wants to jump off the top of the tallest building in a city... You know, over and over again. And I mean, with that, in having it happen in your eyeballs, like, that'd be cool once, but to do it over and over again, or like, even like you said, with the treadmill, like those games, like, you'd be running from like one side of Rome all the way to the other.
That's tough. You couldn't take the games we already have and just kind of transplant them to it. And I don't think everyone wants to do that. I just think that when you look at the small amount of games that would work for it, it's not enough to support it as like a platform. Yeah. Like, it's going to end up being a peripheral, like a Kinect or like a PlayStation Move or something like that. And I think eventually it will just kind of go away.
It's hard to design. I mean, you look at, say, when games jump from... All games were basically 2D up until they had the power to do 3D. And you look at Super Mario 64, and that's always kind of pointed to as the benchmark of, like, they managed to do it right in terms of controlling Mario in a 3D space and making it work. But if you look at a lot of games that came out, you know, right around the same time, man, a lot of them got it wrong. Like, where, I mean, just terrible platformers where, like, jumping doesn't make any sense. It's hard to figure out where to land. It's hard to navigate the world, the way you move your character around. So it's the same thing. Like, there's going to be a whole lot of missteps with VR before they get it just right.
It's like the first system. It's going to slowly take a while to get to where it needs to go.
Yeah, it's just going to be, I mean, if it's going to stick around, there's going to be a lot of trial and error, and mostly error, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah. Next question is from Amber N. She wants to know, what do you think is the most exciting trend in video games from a design perspective? Sort of on a, not necessarily a technical, like, technology perspective, but a design perspective. I mean, Gary, you play a lot. What do you
like? I like that there is mainstream acceptance now for games without kind of traditional win states. Where, like, the example I brought up earlier, like, when you have things like Gone Home and to a lesser extent The Walking Dead, where, like, the goal of the game is to see more of the story and see more of the game. You know, The Walking Dead does a really good job with the illusion of choice. A lot of the choices matter less than you think. Like, if you ever play The Walking Dead again, you know, it's the same story when you play it. But, like, I like the idea of we can kind of play with character rewards where it doesn't have to be numbers going up. It can be how much of this personal story do you want to see? And that's still a game. You're still engaging in it. You're still complicit in the action. So there's an intimacy there. And I really like that as a trend. And I think that we're going to see more of that as kind of making games becomes democratized, like, or becomes more democratized. Like, it's easier than ever to make a game. And it's easier every year to make a game than it was before for just people to kind of make their own thing.
Right. And you think about things like, you know, Gone Home is a great example, made by a very small team. And Gone Home, for those who don't know what it is, the whole game is you come home from college. You're a girl who's, like, college age. You come home. Nobody's home to greet you. And you just go through the house, and you pick up various objects in the house and look at them, and you're trying to figure out where did everybody go and what happened. And that's it. It only takes, like, 2 hours to complete. But as a storytelling experience, it's really it's excellent. And it's the kind of story you can only do through something like a game, because it takes that interactivity to make it happen.
I can't tell if that game would sound good or boring.
See, you have to play it. That's the thing. As a description, it does sound sort of like...
It sounds like... But something I could do in an hour.
Well, that's the brilliance of it, is that, one, it doesn't take very long to do. But it's about you being the detective and just sort of figuring it out. Or a game like Journey is another good example of that. Like,
you told me about that.
Yeah, Journey, you should definitely play that one. I mean, it only takes like 3 hours to do that one, too. And again, there's no death. There's no killing of monsters. It's just sort of you exploring this space and how you feel as you go through it.
Yeah, that to me, that is... that's an important kind of marker in this kind of games as art thing, is that the goal of a game can not necessarily to be fun, but to be, I want to express an idea or get you to feel a feeling that is maybe not a feeling of fun.
Yeah, it's engaging without necessarily being exhilarating in the same way you would expect, fast-paced combat to be. I included this email just because I just thought it was fun. Ryan R. just wrote in and said, "I can't beat this level. What do I do? Arg." But he didn't say what game it was for. So, practice?
I was on a level of Last of Us, when you're in the building and you're trying to get out. And I was stuck for maybe a week. I didn't know what to do. And I look up one time and I'm like, oh, there you go. There's a ladder.
Right. There's definitely, and Dark Souls is a great version of this too. Like, you will beat your head against the wall for a while. But that moment when you finally figure out, aha, here's what I do. That's a great dopamine release. Like, you sort of used that word before. That's a your brain telling you, I did good. Yay.
Before you were an idiot for the last week.
Yeah.
Well, or at least you can, if you're really stuck, you can always go to something like GameFAQs and look up what should I do next. Because that's kind of the beauty of the internet. It does rob you a little bit of that that thrill of discovery. But by the same token, if there's a lot of, if it becomes an impossible gate that is preventing you from enjoying the rest of what's past it in the game, I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to look that up, at least after you've tried for a while.
Yeah.
It's your time. Use it how you want.
Right. And then finally, Logan K. just asked, what are your all-time favorite and least favorite games? That's a hard question to answer, but Brandon, you talked about a few. Is there any others that you consider your favorite and a least favorite?
Well, probably Tricky for the PlayStation 2.
That was your favorite.
Because I haven't beaten Last of Us yet, and I haven't really. But yeah, I think that's one of my favorite games, just because I can play it over and over and not get bored. And least favorite game would have to be Tricky for the Xbox 360.
This is the crashing letdown. Yeah. Okay. Gary, any ideas? I mean, I'm pretty sure I know what your favorite is, but...
Yeah, I mean, it would probably be, just Dark Souls, because Dark Souls is the best of everything, but, there's a bunch of things up there, because I really like, and they all kind of play into what we talked about, too. Like, Deus Ex is really high up there. That's a game that has so much respect for the player and the choices that you make. You can tackle any situation in a bunch of different ways, and it's really respectful. And then the other thing, game I like to bring up a lot is Planescape Torment, which is the game... That has touched my heart more than any other game, and is not as good as it's the best written game I've played. That's really incredible. Least favorite's really hard because I play a lot of bad games.
That's true. You spend a lot of time in that pit.
Yeah, that's really tricky. It's hard to think of the worst thing that we've done for that. Maybe
you're pretty down on Soul Reaver.
Soul Reaver's really bad, and that's that feels like a more honest answer than even something like the Nintendo X-Men game or something, because Soul Reaver is at least you can get through it. It's not broken. It's just really badly designed. Sure, I'd say Soul Reaver.
The second you put that on the poll, I was like, oh, if only he'd picked the sequel, he'd be so much... Yeah. I'm not saying you would love it, but you wouldn't have just been punching yourself in the head. It's I played the sequel first, and then I was like, oh, I should go play the original, see if I missed anything. Nope, I did not.
It's pretty inexcusable.
Yeah. For me, favorite, I'll say Final Fantasy VI. That's an easy answer. It's a very popular game. But I remember that being sort of... I enjoyed 4 a lot. I remember loving in the America, they actually got released as 1, 2, and 3. Because in Japan, there were Final Fantasy games that never came out here. So they're technically... It's technically 6, but it's really 3 in America. Anyway. But yeah, 2 I loved, or 4. That was the... First one, 6, where they really sort of opened it up. It felt like a huge world with a lot to do in it. They did a couple of things with the storytelling that really sort of flipped normal video game conventions on their head, where you had been playing as one character as basically your main protagonist out of many for half of the game, and then all of a sudden that character gets sidelined, the entire world gets destroyed, and now everything about the game changes in the middle to almost a completely different thing. And I remember being, about maybe 13 or so your age when that came out, and I was just thinking that was an incredibly bold move. On top of the brilliant production design, and the actual gameplay is fun, and the music is perfect. So that'd be my all-time favorite. Least favorite. Oh, man. God, there's so many terrible games. I don't even know what to say for a least favorite. There was a, my mom's going to hate this because she's going to listen to this, but this was a game where I used to play when I was a kid. I actually suggested it for Abject Suffering, so if it comes up, enjoy. But it's a game called Journey to the Planets, which I loved when I was a kid. This was an Atari game, and the whole game was you would go from, you'd be in a little spaceship, and you'd fly around, and you'd have to land on 7 different planets that would be randomly scattered throughout the map, and you'd have to recover a treasure from each planet to complete the game. Looking back, and I loved it as a kid, but looking back on it, I realized that game was terrible because it gave you no clues as to what you were supposed to do. And when you finally figure out what you were supposed to do, it was so random that I don't know how I ever managed to beat it. And I was like maybe 5 or 6 when I actually completed that game. I have no idea how, but go back and look at it. It's just bizarre. No one's ever heard of it. No one remembers it. And my mom used to think, oh, that was such a good game because it gave you puzzles to solve. But they weren't looking like sort of like we talked about. They weren't puzzles.
Yeah, they weren't puzzles. It was just guessing. I'm looking at screenshots of it now. Yeah.
I mean, first of all, the graphics are terrible. So it's very hard to, I mean, they're forgivable because it's from 1984 or 5. So, I mean, it's pretty primitive graphics. So you couldn't figure out what things were supposed to be, what things in the environment you could interact with versus couldn't interact with versus would kill you instantly.
Yeah.
So it was like just tons of meaningless trial and error. So I'll put that one up there. Sorry, Mom. I know you loved it. But anyway, I think that probably wraps it up, right?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Gary, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. It was a lot of fun to have you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to plug your shows a little more, so go to duckfeed.tv, which is all of Gary's different podcasts. He's got Watch Out for Fireballs, which is the Good Game Book Club, Abject Suffering, which is the Bad Game Book Club, Bonfireside Chat, which is specifically about the Dark Souls series of games. For games from those developers, and you've got to be ramping up there because Dark Souls 3 comes out in a month.
Oh yeah.
Or so.
I'm
bummed. I'm very concerned. I'm not going to have any time to play it. I'm going to be a father any day now.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thanks. So, which is cool. I'm very excited about that, much more so than Dark Souls. But I do know that I will have no time to just sink into that in a month. But maybe later. I'll try and listen along at least.
I'm going to be a father of Dark Souls 3.
Yeah, I think so.
So I'm
about a 9-month gestation for you and Cole.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Well, cool. And so if you like our show and you want to write to us, just go to quarksandrec.com. Go to our Facebook group, which is facebook.com/quarksandrec, or tweet us at quarksandrec, or email us at quarksandrec.com. You get the idea. We haven't decided on what our next show is going to be yet. I think we've got to narrow down to a couple of topics, so we'll post that on our Facebook group pretty soon. And with that, I think that'll just about do it. Thanks again, Gary. Really, really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Thanks, guys. It's nice to meet you.
Nice. Very nice to meet you as well. Yeah. All right. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Oh, thank you.